I'm also joined by my colleague, Adam Paul.
Who's good morning.
Here. Hi, Adam.
Well, Scott, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it. I know this is going to go over a lot of ground that, you know, you've discussed and written about, but bear with us for a sec. Who were the Quants?
Well, Quants covers a broad category. Within the industry, there's sort of this arcane debate about who is a Quant and who's not. For my purposes, in my book, I basically use a very broad brush and apply to anybody who uses math and computers to effectively trade or price securities in markets. So you have, say, statistical arbitrage quants who are trading in various markets in securities based on their relative value.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have, say, fixed income quants who are using mathematics and computers to price mortgage securities or collateralized debt obligations. You have risk managers that work at banks or hedge funds who use mathematical formulas to assess the risk parameters of the firm's investment, mm-hmm. using, you know, typically something like value at risk. You have options traders, and a lot of quantitative formulas go back to the Black-Scholes option pricing formula of the early 70s. And, it runs the gamut. I mean, my contention is that, you know, all of these things combined have dramatically changed the way Wall Street works, and Wall Street is essentially floating on a sea of mathematics and computer power that has, as many others have pointed out, in some inherent flaws and in the application of financial markets.
Right. And I know there's no one date when all this begins, but roughly what time are you dating for the arrival of quants on the scene?
There were some, you know, sort of incipient bubblings of quant activities in the 60s. I focus in my book on Ed Thorpe, a MIT professor who had initially used computers and math to crack blackjack and, mm-hmm. and actually go to Las Vegas and use his formulas to apply a card counting strategy to win a blackjack, and he eventually realized that he could make a lot more money on Wall Street and developed mathematical formulas to price convertible bonds. So that he set up his hedge fund in the late 60s. That's sort of an artificial beginning, and people have been using math on Wall Street for, you know, long before that. Obviously, I mean, people have always been using some form of mathematics, and I think that it started becoming much more widely used in the 70s when computers appeared on the scene, and I guess a lot of people would date the true beginning of the so-called quantitative revolution with the Fisher-Black option pricing formula that I'd mentioned earlier, which I believe was published in 1973. And at the same time, you started seeing options traded in markets in Chicago. The futures industry began taking off, and that's, you know, really when it became extremely widespread in the 70s.
Right. And what went awry in the financial crisis? In terms of the quants, I mean, obviously there was, you know, many factors contributing to the financial crisis.
Right. That's a hard question because there's so many things that went wrong. And
Well, let me start with just this whole model error in terms of, you know, collateralized debt obligations, which were getting all these AAA ratings and turned out to be much more fragile. What went wrong?
Well, you know, it apparently the Wall Street and many of the rating agencies were using a formula that had been devised in the late 90s and early 2000s to price CDOs or even, you know, more complex structures called synthetic collateralized debt obligations.
Sure.
It was a formula called the Gaussian Cocula, created by David Lee, who he was a quant who had worked in a number of banks, and he ended up at J.P. Morgan, which was one of the places that really, you know, these derivative products had been created at J.P. Morgan. You know, it's an extremely complex formula that uses credit default swaps and the prices of credit default swaps to track the correlations of various tranches and the default probabilities of the tranches.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know all of the specifics of why this formula was flawed. I talked to many, many different quants about it, and it seemed like, you know, at the end of the day, it was just the complexity of the formula. It was so arcane and you know, it was relying on all these sort of, you know, assumptions about how markets work that were really just, you know, sort of existed in the minds of these financial engineers and had little to do with the real world. One, you know, obvious assumption that they had all made, which is pretty simple, is that, you know, you plug into these formulas assumptions about certain prices and the direction of certain prices in the future to figure out where they're going to be priced in the future. And almost, you know, across Wall Street, everybody was assuming that housing prices were going to continue to rise or at least remain flat. And this is the case at the banks and at the rating agencies. And, you know, at the end of the day, you can dig into all the complexity of these formulas, but that was the major flaw that happened. And when prices started going down, the formulas apparently stopped working. You couldn't even price these products anymore. They sort of entered a black hole because, for one thing, trading thinned out dramatically. So there, you know, one way to price these is you look at what some sort of related tranche, you know, maybe a tranche that's full of all sorts of Southern California subprime mortgages, and you try to correlate that to a tranche in your own bespoke synthetic CDO and come up with a price. Since when trading dried up, they weren't able to get that price. There was no way to get any correlation to apply that to the structure. So basically, you ended up with a market that entered a black hole, and everybody was, just completely in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that's just one thing. I mean, there. Sure. You know, I mentioned the risk management and value at risk, and that's just another, you know, sort of somewhat egregious failure of risk management and quantitative formulas. This, you know, all the banks were using BAR to measure their risk, and they all proved to be wildly underestimating what the risks were at the banks.
Right. Did you have a question, Ed?
I do have to ask, how similar were these models across different institutions? I mean, were they all sort of using very similar models, or was there a lot of differentiation?
Well, The Gaussian copula formula was used across Wall Street. Everybody was using this formula, from what I understand. I think that some of the banks had teams of quants who came up with their own methodologies to price these things. But by and large, it was, probably everybody had their own little tweaks on the model, but this was the model that everybody used. And, apparently the banks brought these models to the rating agencies. At least that's what I was told. And the rating agencies adopted them, which is, obviously a problem in and of itself. The banks were sort of dictating to the rating agencies how they should price these extremely complex securities. And, it seemed to work for a while. It's one of those things where, because of how this model worked, everybody loved it because it was just like a trick. And, it was very hard for a long time to figure out how to price these structures, apparently. And when David Lee came up with this model, all you needed to do is to look at what the price of the of relative credit default swaps were in the market. So there you had it. You had this, something that you could look at and then correlate that to your model. So, it seemed to work, but there ended up being huge flaws in it. And now, there's this great push towards coming up with the next model, which is kind of scary because, I wonder what they're going to come up with now.
Right. If you look around the executive suites of these financial institutions, they've come up as bond traders. Bob Rubin was a lawyer before Goldman Sachs. Jamie Dimon was just a regular banker. What difference did it make that the folks on top were not themselves quants, if any?
Well, I think that's a huge problem. You have these giant institutions that are, in my opinion, being run as a quantitative machine, and the guys in charge it kind of speaks to how new a lot of this is. It takes decades to rise to the top of one of these huge institutions. So you've got, these guys who came of age in the 60s and the 70s, and they just sort of look at the quants as being back office rocket scientists who are helping the traders a little bit come up with models, but really, at the end of the day, it's the traders who are running the show. And that's just not the case anymore. The traders are becoming more and more quantitative themselves. Universities have all programs that are dedicated to financial engineering, these guys have very little experience with that. I think there's some exceptions to that, and Vikram Pandit would be one. He kind of comes out of this world. He understands it, but, Pandit took over Citi after the worst had been done, so it's kind of hard to, pin the blame for what happened at Citi on him. I agree. The lawyers were in charge by and large, or just, people who were traders. And I think that was, definitely part of the problem. That said, I don't know if it would have made much of a difference,
right?
Because the quants themselves were sort of enthralled by the math and helped lead everybody down this rabbit hole of complexity and math. And, so would it really have made much of a difference if this, CEO was, knew about this? It may not have. It could have made it worse. Goldman Sachs, is probably a good example of a firm that has pretty effective risk management.
Mm-hmm.
And, from what I hear, people who really do understand the nature of the models, the drawbacks of the models, the fact that you can have extremely volatile moves in the market, and in Lloyd Blankfein, as I understand it, is a pretty smart guy. So Goldman is, you know, they did manage to come through a lot of this without suffering the same pain. They also were able to exploit the failings of others who weren't quite as smart as them, and you know, I think that's part of the reason why they've come under so much fire.
Right. Good.
Okay. I mean, so we've actually heard from a couple people about sort of the interaction between sort of top executives and the quants, but how were the quants perceiving themselves? I mean, were they sort of aspiring to be executives? Were they communicating with sort of people outside of the model world within the firm?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I was writing my book, I was really trying to find an example of a guy who had been, you know, waving the red flag and saying, danger, danger, you know, this is, you know, we're going off a cliff here. And I talked to risk managers and, you know, it just seemed like they were all sort of, even if they did think that something was, you know, bad was going to happen, they felt muffled. And I don't know if it's whether that's the kind of people that, you know, a lot of these guys are fairly introverted and, you know, they didn't feel like they had the power to say much, but I think also many of them didn't see what was coming. And, you know, they believed in the models, and there were people, if you look at a lot of the people who saw, who actually did see what was, coming down the road, they were more like your trade-by-the-gut guys. You know, Paulson was not a quant. I mean, he did hire quants, but and a number of these hedge funds that made bets against, you know, what was going on, just were able to look outside into the real world and see that you know, the whole economy was heading towards something pretty bad. You know, so one risk manager told me, you know, the way it would work is in meetings with top executives at banks. You know, a quant would say, okay, you know, this is, you know, we're using too much leverage here, and I think we need to cut back by X amount. The opinions would go around the table. The trader would say, okay, I've got a gut feel for this. I feel really good about this. And they would end up meeting them halfway. So, so even if there was a quant who was in the firm complaining, a lot of times they were overruled, or you know, they weren't listened to.
Right.
I hope that answers the question. I don't know, it's kind of rambling, but
no, it does. And we'll start to wind down because we know you got to go. On regulation, how much? Let me ask a couple of part question. I mean, how much of what they were doing was with the purpose of coming up with complex models that evaded regulation? And going forward, do you think regulation would make much of a difference?
Mm. Well, you know, I probably don't know as much about this as I should, but, you know, I think that many derivative products are created to, you know, arbitrage regulations. They call it regulatory arbitrage. So you get a swap that isn't, you know, you're not able to do some sort of transaction in your local currency. So you do an interest rate swap with a firm in Europe. You do the transaction in euros, or the other firm does the transaction, and then you swap the liabilities. I think that is really widespread. So, you know, in the derivative world, it is, you know, a large amount of it is designed to sidestep regulations. And, you know, you have quantum physicists who are sitting around trying to think about ways to get around, you know, restrictions on, you know, how much you can hold on your balance sheet, you know, how much a bank can hold on its balance sheet in, you know, European bonds. So they'll swap out something in the bonds that they have into something that's related to it, and they end up getting very similar exposure. You know, I'm sure you guys have looked into that, and I wish I knew more about it. It's a, you know, probably an area ripe for investigation.
Right.
You know, in terms of how the regulators are going to control that, it's really hard because basically, you know, what, you know, the international financial world enables people to do is to step outside of their own federal regulatory environment and, you know, trade overseas in ways that allow them to get around local, you know, or federal regulations. So, you know, maybe more stringent leverage ratios would be something that could help curb that a little bit. But even that is difficult because that's another thing that swaps can enable banks to, you know, get leverage in ways that are often invisible.
Right. Let me ask you just finally, and thanks for your time. You know, one of the joys of this commission is we have subpoena power and no jurisdictional boundaries. So what would you like to know about this topic that you don't know and that you think we should train our investigation on?
You know, I think that, and some of this has come out with the Goldman investigation into Abacus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talked to a number of people in the CDO industry, you know, going back to, you know, 2007, 2006, and there is this belief among a number of people that these financial institutions that were, you know, setting, like Goldman and like Deutsche Bank and others, and even in, you know, into the CDO management industry, you know, firms like Tricadia and Cohen and Company were extremely aware of what was going on and were, you know, positioning themselves in ways to benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the SEC is delving into that, but I just, you know, I think, and I know that some you know, investigative reporters at the Journal are convinced that there's a lot more there that hasn't come out in terms of who knew what. And I always felt like, you know, I wanted to write more about that, but it was extremely hard to prove. And I, you know, I always felt like you needed subpoena power. You needed to look at the emails that were being exchanged by these traders. And that, I always felt like that was going to how it would come out, that they would be exchanging emails with one another saying, you know, I can't believe this idiot is buying this crap. And I've just been told, like, so many people knew how, you know, how this thing was a house of cards and it was going to come tumbling down, is, you know, in 2006. And there's this, you know, people say that, you know, everybody thought housing was going to keep going up, but people involved in this industry, you know, yes, there were a number of stupid people who bought this stuff, and a lot of them were Europeans who really didn't know what they were doing, and they believed in the ratings. But, you know, I just really think that the, you know, the Wall Street banks or these traders, a number of them were more aware than, you know, they've let on.
Right.
And that whole industry of the, you know, firms like Tricadia. I mean, I would look at Tricadia.
Gotcha. Well, Scott, you've been generous with your time. We appreciate it. So,
okay, hopefully it was helpful.
Yeah, it was. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.